So our title this morning is The Cultural Context of American Worship, which I devised as one of those titles that you give event planners when you have no idea what you're going to talk about. We could also call it The Cultural Context of American Christianity, because worship and Christianity are almost synonymous, or should be. And I'm going to do some fairly broad history today. A lot of people think of those of us in the news business as chasing headlines. When I was at the Associated Press, the slogan for the company is "Deadline Every Minute," which is literally true with that outfit. But we're going to look at some history and also some inventions and innovations that are very important as we look across the grand pattern of biblical people and people in the human race. 21st century Americans tend to be caught up in the moment and perhaps look to the future, and it's very easy to ignore the past. But in pondering culture's impact upon worship, which today is undergoing the most sweeping change, the biggest burst of creativity, the most confusion and disruption that we've ever seen in North America, it's useful to look backward and remind ourselves where we came from. And to get us thinking in this direction, I'm going to talk about something that has absolutely nothing to do with the rest of the talk, and that is environmental disease. Now, we think of environmental disease as very contemporary, something that developed in the 20th and 21st centuries. For instance, DDT was invented to help control insect pests and to improve farmers' work and to help world hunger, all good things. But, of course, it had toxic side effects. Or use of asbestos, which was designed to prevent fires, but also had negative effects that we've come to learn. But environmental diseases actually go back at least to the 15th century. The inventions were improvements made in the distilling of alcohol. And what this did was cause a great increase in use of strong drink across Europe, which tended to supplant weaker beer and wine as well as non-alcoholic drinks. And the result was an epidemic of alcohol abuse, which remains with us in 2008. And drinking of addictive hard liquor became so widespread and such a big problem that, think about this, as you know, the Congress of the United States and three-fourths of the American states approved a ban on the manufacture and sale of, the exact phrase was, intoxicating liquors. Now, of course, we don't have prohibition anymore, but we do, by government action, suppress use of cigarettes, and we have prohibitions on some of these toxic chemicals. So that type of approach is still with us. Now, turning more directly toward the topic of the day, the same 15th century saw a remarkable technological advance that was totally positive in its effects. In ancient China, paper was invented, and printing also was invented by the clever folks in ancient China. But what happened, as you know, in 15th century Germany, was movable type and improvements in the technology of printing, and we get the Gutenberg Bible, of course, the beginning of publishing and printing. Now, there's important history long before that, since printing flourished in languages that used the alphabet. And Nathan Burma did a piece about this in the Chicago Tribune in 2004. Nathan's on the staff here at the Calvin Institute, pointing out what a remarkable and important invention the alphabet was. Because before that time, writing was done with pictographs or cuneiform, hieroglyphics, this type of thing. And what you had to do is memorize thousands of characters. And the alphabet presented the possibility and eventually the fact of mass literacy, that the average person with fairly limited education, in case of my grandfather, 3 months of formal education, as an immigrant from Sweden. And yet he was quite literate despite that, because the alphabet, you can grasp and get a fair amount of literacy. It's a very flexible way to present ideas and words and put them down on paper. Now, when you had the hieroglyphic and cuneiform system, writing and reading was the business of an elite class of scribes. We're told, for instance, the pharaohs of Egypt were probably illiterate, or may well have been, because they depended on these professional writers to do that task, and they didn't need to read and write. Now, another ancient invention which was popularized by early Christians was the predecessor of what we call the book, and it was the codex. So rather than rolling up a scroll, which was awkward and had a limited word count, you could put leaves, which you could, you know, turn over and so on, and turn back and forth, a very clever and a very flexible invention. The codex paved the way for what we think of as the book. So the ancient alphabet and modern printing made possible inexpensive publication and distribution in large quantities of groups of words. Eventually, this led to democratic government and what we can call democratic worship and democratic church life. And it's no coincidence that it was only decades after the Gutenberg Bible that the Protestant Reformation erupted, with its insistence on common literacy, Bible reading by all parishioners and in their own languages. The Reformers also created a popular movement. They did this by distributing tens of thousands of propaganda pamphlets across Northern Europe. Therefore, we can say that Protestantism was the first religion whose advent was made possible by scientific and technological innovation. Think about that. So therefore, you might say alcoholism and Protestantism both arose through technological advance in the very same period of years. Strange to think of that. The approach to worship and faith in general in Protestantism was popular and heavily text-oriented. Representative government inevitably accompanied these religious and cultural changes. And then in the 19th century, very cheap publications became a true mass phenomenon, mass media, thanks to further technological advances such as the linotype machine and things of that sort. Fast action printing presses and so on, replacing the more tedious placing of individual little bits of letters into frames and so on and so forth. Very interesting history. Okay, now we're 5.5 centuries beyond Gutenberg, and we are moving into a very different cultural epoch. To a considerable extent, printed material is being replaced by video entertainment and internet browsing. It's a new world. And it's just like distilled spirits replacing wine, beer, or fruit juices. So this type of visual communication is replacing print. Now, I would contend that the acquiring of information and opinion on computer screens is more haphazard and less useful in most cases than printed matter when you're talking about absorbing long, complex, and information-rich bodies of writing. For instance, you can mark up a printed page. You can have your spouse read the same book or article and see what they think of your remarks, or they can put remarks on it. You can go back years later and see what markings you made, and it helps you remember really quickly if you need to bone up in a hurry on something. Not only that, reading of published material in a comfortable chair is a more pleasurable experience, I would argue, than sitting at the computer screen. An author named Lee Siegel has a new book out criticizing internet culture titled Against the Machine, in which he argues that the acquiring of mere information is not the same thing as knowledge. For instance, the internet is wonderful if you are trying to find the best flight from Detroit to San Diego, or You want to see what the side effects are on some medication that you're on, or many other wonderful things you can check in a hurry. Sometimes you can get misinformation on the internet. I don't need to tell you that also. But it's not necessarily ideal for reflective reading and absorbing of complex material. The Bible comes immediately to mind in this regard. Siegel also complains that computer use is as addictive as alcohol has become and erodes community and human interaction, a point that we'll be returning to. You may have seen a feature in the New York Times in November about the Jump Up Internet Rescue School. Don't you love that name? The Jump Up Internet Rescue School is a camp in South Korea aimed at curing children from their addiction to the computer screen. They can't tear themselves away. And so this camp tries to change that behavior pattern. The article claimed that this addiction is being identified by psychologists as a mental health problem in the United States and in other countries. Another article, very interesting, the last issue of 2007 of the New Yorker magazine had an article called Twilight of the Books, written by Caleb Crane. He reported research which probably is generally familiar to everyone here, but he documented Americans' dramatic decline in reading during the television, video, and internet age. He said, quote, "Americans are losing not just the will to read, but even the ability." The latest government reports tell us that as of 2005, roughly 70% of eighth graders are not proficient in reading. 70% of eighth graders are not proficient in reading. I thought of my grandfather when I read that, you can imagine. Lower reading skill, of course, correlates with worsened academic achievement. But it also correlates with declines in employment, wage levels, exercising, volunteering, voting, and attendance at music concerts, at art museums, and going to the theater. And one can ask, can church attendance be far behind? With the internet, psychologists see less of these negative effects when you're looking at text on the screen as opposed to when you're on the internet looking at streaming video or still pictures. There is something about text that's different from video. Now, books may survive this cyberspace revolution going on around us, but perhaps magazines and newspapers, to which I myself have devoted a working career, are in danger of severe economic decline. Which has already started, but even worse in coming years as advertising continues to drain into new media. In my view, people who read quality printed periodicals will always be the culture's powerful decision makers in the arts, politics, economics, and societal values. They will rule, but in the future they may well become an elite class, rather like those scribes writing cuneiform in ancient Egypt. And this, of course, has major implications for Western democracy. But it also has effects on Christianity, which is our interest this morning, and especially Protestant Christianity, which is dependent on democratic worship, that is, full participation of lay members with wide use of printed material in and out of worship. Future churchgoers may be less adept at and less interested in reading of complex texts, most importantly, the Bible. Christianity will survive whatever happens in some form because from the New Testament times and for about 15 centuries afterward, most Christians had little access to any written materials, and in any event, would have been illiterate and unable to read them. So Christianity was presented and thrived and passed on to succeeding generations without the benefit of print. But if widespread use of print, But if 21st century culture rolls backwards several centuries toward semi-literacy, this could undercut Protestant culture as we know it, which has been built, again, on personal appropriation of the scriptures and study of doctrine, and necessarily depends upon widespread ability and interest in reading and writing. And this, in turn, will affect worship. Churches will need to rely more and more upon strategies aimed at stimulating the eye and the ear. Of course, this has always been with us. I mean, old examples would be banners, attractive displays of organ pipes, stained glass windows. Some newer examples would be liturgical dance or mime in worship, or use of art installations and symbols. I was just at a workshop with some very interesting examples of experiments and ways in which tactile and visual effects can underscore the theme in the sermon or the scripture readings of the day. And it's apparently had a great effect on people. Even years later will remember the event or an effect that something visual had upon them. So these are all areas in which people are thinking hard, and for good reason. Worship planners will also be required to pay attention not only to beauty and symbol in the worship experience, but the visual aspects of worship spaces, and also the attractiveness of oral expression and recitations. There's a lot can be done there. Of special importance, of course, will be church music and the quality of church music, a resource that has so greatly enhanced verbal presentation of the scriptures, sermons, and prayers in worship. And as with the history of printed Bibles, books, pamphlets, and mass literacy, the ability to read music by nearly everyone has been a necessary aspect of Protestant worship. But I sense that the teaching of this very basic cultural skill in our school systems is eroding in this generation. Now, for the following history, I'm indebted to a book by Andrew Wilson Dixon of the Welsh College of Music and Drama, published in 1992, titled The Story of Christian Music. During about 1,000 years after the time of Christ, not only were books very rare and worshippers mostly illiterate, but music was never written down. It had to be passed on by memory alone. And just as Bible reading and study was limited to an elite, so musical illiteracy meant that worship music was the business of a special class of people who had the time and the ability to memorize a lot of tunes. It just doesn't happen automatically. Again, like those scribes in ancient Egypt writing on their pieces of clay. But eventually, scholarly monks, one of whom was very important, Guido d'Arezzo, in 11th century Italy, began inventing ways to actually write down music, just like we also write down words, producing musical notation. This was a remarkable development. It ended musical illiteracy, and it made possible sight reading so that congregations could sing together and could sing a lot of different songs, and they didn't have to memorize all of them. Wilson Dixon makes the very important observation that the combining of worship words with music by everybody was of immense help in committing the content of the Bible to memory and to the mind. And just as with the reading of printed Bibles, musical notation eventually made possible the involvement of each and every worshiper in singing, and very often in four-part harmony, which is fundamental to Protestant worship. And, of course, a wide selection of songs could be made available because of the development of printing in the 15th century. Thus, we have the hymnal, which is, again, a remarkable resource. Hundreds of different tunes that are available instantly to congregations that wish to worship. This also has ecumenical implications. According to the preface of the hymnal titled Sing a New Creation, which is used especially in Reformed churches. The preface says, quote, "One of the losses when hymns are no longer used, one of the losses when hymnals are no longer used is a common body of songs. In this past generation, the number of hymns known by most Christians, even within denominations, has shrunk dramatically. What is a favorite in one congregation may be unknown to another, often making it difficult for Christians to worship together. The editors of this hymnal say that hymnals are important for encouraging Christians to sing songs that connect them to the large body of Christ, universal. Now, musical notation and printing also made possible centuries of art music, anthems, more complex compositions whose performance by church choirs and in Sunday worship and the concert stage for classical compositions has enriched religious and indeed secular culture. The British theologian Jeremy Begbie reflects in a new book about singing the national anthem on a visit to South Africa. Now, our Star-Spangled Banner here in the United States is usually sung by a soloist, and when it's sung by a group, they usually have trouble singing it because it's a rather difficult song. But this writer says when the South African national anthem is sung, the gathered audience instantly and very naturally falls into a four-part harmony in which the melody line does not dominate the rest. And Begbie writes that with these overlapping sounds, the distinct voices mutually establish and enhance one another, which evokes an extraordinary sense of togetherness and carries out in sound the people's relationship to each other that God has made possible. The very same could be said for Protestant congregational worship at its best. And just a word about another invention from the similar centuries we've been looking back at, the pipe organ, which proved to be ideal for accompanying straightforward, simple hymn tunes sung by large groups in church. I would say that instruments like the piano and the guitar are very useful with groups of perhaps a dozen or two. The pipe organ is ideally designed for large group singing. Now, as with reading and texts and things of that sort, this Christian musical culture is also gradually eroding around us during this era. To some extent, the contemporary Christian music or CCM boom may be driven by business calculations because you can earn more money from new tunes than you do from old tunes and hymnals that are in the public domain. But leaving that rather cynical point aside, worshipers who resist CCM may reflect more than just simple musical preferences or prejudices or a general opposition to change. The resistors may somehow sense that the loss of choirs, anthems, and classical concerts represents a narrowing of the Christian heritage. But more important for our purposes is what happens in congregational worship. Quite often, the contemporary tunes have circuitous musical lines and tricky rhythms, and sometimes the words don't quite fit easily with the music. In other words, these are difficult for large groups of folks with ordinary musical ability to sing together cleanly and correctly. These tunes are often designed for specialized performers, again, like the scribes in ancient Egypt. Large groups have more difficulty, and we're rolling things, therefore, back 1,000 years before the rise of musical literacy. Congregations that favor CCM typically rely on vocal combos and worship bands that push out the songs, and that shifts the focus, very often also the actual singing, away from the gathered people of God and toward performers up there on the stage. And in this way, it affects the practical ecclesiology, the very doctrine of the church, and the priesthood of all believers. We could also discuss the economics of the new music, because of course bands and sound systems and the rest do cost money, but the same can be said for pipe organs. So in a way, you're going to pay one way or the other. Now think of another invention that was unknown for most of Christian history until the mid-1920s, electronic amplification. This makes possible the existence of revival meetings and the so-called megachurch, with thousands of worshipers who need to hear the sermon. But it also, so to speak, amplifies the musical problem. Thomas Day, who's the music chairman of Salve Regina College in Rhode Island, wrote a book years ago called Why Catholics Can't Sing. And one of the problems he described was frustrated worship leaders hoping to overcome lackluster participation from folks out in the pews. They would sing worship songs ever more loudly into the microphone, insisting that folks come along, but that only suppresses the congregation's singing rather than helping it. Many Protestants have experienced this same phenomenon. Also, I may just throw in that as with DDT and asbestos, there are medical problems with the increase in amplification, since people exposed to artificially and dangerously loud music at Christian concerts or Sunday worship can actually risk damage to a hearing. In a talk to a fellow journalist some years ago, I was asked to give tips on covering American revivals. And I said the first and the most important rule is to keep earplugs in your briefcase, because you never know when your sense of hearing is going to be assaulted in a church setting. Another huge phenomenon of this era is secularization. This has really been thrown before church folks in a dramatic way by all of these militant atheistic books in the last 2 years by Dawkins, Dennett, Harris, Hitchens, and other writers. They are noted for hating any and all religions. Then there's a subclass of writers who hate conservative Christianity, and especially when it has political impact. A good example of this type of literature is a recent book by Chris Hedges, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign correspondent for the New York Times. And the book is just filled with, I would say, distortions, but also contempt for folks on the conservative end of the spectrum, religiously and politically. Hedges, by the way, is a graduate of the Harvard Divinity School. So he comes at it with that type of background and is the son of a Presbyterian pastor. Now, what does this do to us, and where are we? Western Europe, and to a lesser extent Canada, are engaged in an experiment that is unparalleled in human history, namely defection from all religious faith and worship as a mass phenomenon. We've never seen this in the history of the human race. But this has essentially arisen since World War II. Now, we need to distinguish that from as voluntary secularization, as distinguished from forced secularization like we had during the communist years, where the government is forcing atheism upon the population. So far, this type of strong mass secular population has not permeated America, that is the United States, except for elites in the academic world and the mass media. Just look at all the religion that's sloshing around the presidential campaign in both the Republican and Democratic parties. But many Americans in the so-called baby boom generation dropped out of church, and they had to be drawn or dragged back in by any means necessary, and thus was born the seeker-sensitive or user-friendly type of Christian meeting on Saturday nights or Sunday mornings, usually featuring CCM and entertaining efforts to make church seem like it's not church. We're all familiar with theater seats replacing pews, video screens that might turn sanctuaries into auditoriums, transparent pulpits or non-existent pulpits, preachers who prowl the premises sort of like caged tigers with roving microphones, and sometimes sounding like stand-up comics, wearing fluorescent shirts instead of the sober black suit that preachers are accustomed to using, skits tucked in along with sermons, and systematic elimination of many other churchly things, robes, choirs, hymnals, pipe organs, written liturgies, moments to dwell on the confession of sins, or even Sunday celebrations of baptism and communion, which do not occur in some secret churches. And for goodness sake, do not pass an offering plate, which might turn off our self-absorbed attendees. There was a minor scandal, you may remember this, 2005, Christmas Day, some secret churches even canceled Sunday worship because it fell Sunday was Christmas, and they didn't want to force people to interrupt their family celebrations by dragging themselves off to worship. I think there's no better example of market-driven churchmanship trumping tradition, considering that Christians had gathered to worship each and every Sunday for the preceding 102,000 weeks, going back 20 centuries. So there's quite a bit involved in interrupting that Sunday worship. Such churches often sidestep not only tradition, but concerns about beauty. And this extends even to the buildings where people worship. A very interesting Catholic complaint about this comes from a British architect named Moira Dourley in a recent book she titled No Place for God. Now, I quickly should add that a lot of the things she says in the book would be disputed by any Protestants in the room. And I myself like a number of the churches that she's complaining about. But I would like to raise the main point in her book for your consideration. Namely, that the visual effect of modern church design often is to downplay the sense that worshipers are coming together into the presence of a transcendent and sovereign God, and also to eliminate the distinction between sacred space over against the workaday world with its mundane sort of interests. But of course, this fits the modern mood and the market. This architect further asserts that such design is one of the cultural factors that fosters narcissism and actual heresy, because it encourages worship of the supposed divinity developed within the individual, as opposed to worship of the one true and majestic God beyond the self. I myself see a related tendency in some of the personal fulfillment hymns that come down to us from the sentimental 19th century hymn writers. And many of these are popular today in Protestant churches. She complains that modern churches resemble conference halls with functional furniture and have exteriors that make the buildings resemble any other building, maybe a health center, a public library, or a dentist's office. And she says, quote, "The modern age has witnessed the construction of the most banal and uninspiring churches in history. Contemporary church buildings, as well as being the ugliest ever built, are also the emptiest," end of quote. Now, that's an observation in Britain, where, indeed, many churches are empty. And as I said, I think a lot of them are quite beautiful myself, both the modern and the more traditional. But it's a very thought-provoking book and an interesting question to ponder. Now, speaking of empty churches, this, of course, fits our theme of secularization like a glove. Secularization is a future threat to every church in the United States. Its impact is already seen very heavily in one segment of Christianity, the unprecedented decline in church membership suffered by so-called mainline or old-line U.S. denominations. These are the churches that have origins in colonial times or the early American Republic and are quickly and easily identified by predominantly white denominations that are affiliated with the National Council of Churches and the World Council of Churches. To be specific, here are some notable declines in net membership since 1970. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, down 14%, or 16% if you count the folks who quit the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and joined a predecessor group. United Methodist Church, even more, down 24%. The Episcopal Church, down 32%. And I might add, that number is going to go up. The United Church of Christ, down 38%. There's actually been a very quiet and unnoticed schism in the United Church of Christ community, with congregations quietly leaving on their own because they have congregational ownership. The Presbyterian Church USA, down 43%. Though we should note that the Presbyterian Church in America schism was part of that decline, but by no means the majority of it. The Christian Church Disciples of Christ has declined by half in membership over the same years. And we could cite similar statistics for the Anglican Church of Canada and the United Church of Canada. Now, you might say, well, all religions are going down, so therefore, we're all caught in the same boat. But in fact, during these same decades, conservative, Protestant, and Roman Catholic congregations held steady or actually grew. That also appears the case with black Protestants, although we do lack reliable statistics on that. For instance, here are some membership increases since 1970. Southern Baptist Convention is up 40%. The Roman Catholic Church is up 43%. The Assemblies of God has increased by an impressive 166%. This is a predominantly white Pentecostal body, as you probably know. Now, how do we explain this? There's a lot of talk about this, and I don't think anybody has quite the answer, though I'm going to suggest one. Well, were mainline Protestants hurt by their leaders' promotion of politics? There's no evidence of decline among congregations that got involved in the religious right movement during the past quarter century. Mainline leaders were on the left side of politics. Does that mean that mainline leaders' liberal politics hurt and conservative politics helped? I'm not sure. By the way, contrary to what you might assume from reading some secular media, we know from the National Congregation Study that evangelical Protestant congregations have been and remain less involved in politics than those in other blocks of American religion, namely mainline Protestants, black Protestants, Jews, and Roman Catholics. We could discuss how Sunday morning is affected positively and negatively by politics, but I'll leave that aside, but you can think about that. Now, was the mainliners' pluralistic and more liberal theology to blame for the decline? Well, certainly in some situations, conservative congregations and individuals have left liberal groups, as is occurring right now in the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Church of Canada over the issues of biblical authority and sexual morality. But remember, as I mentioned, 100,000 people left the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod because it was too conservative. So there's kind of a two-way flow going on. Some people might say mainline churches' traditional music and worship style played a part in this. But I think the best explanation is probably rather simple, that the losing denominations have members, and importantly children of members, who are rather uncertain about their own faith and beliefs, and at the same time are especially vulnerable to trends, fads, and pressures from secularization in American society. Now, we should realize that church growth and decline is actually a complicated business, and it blends a variety of factors. Often people say, oh, conservatives are going up, liberals are going down, therefore people are quitting liberal churches and going to conservative churches. That's true in some cases, but it's more complicated. If you look at this crazy diagram here, imagine this is a large water tank. And this is the water line here. Here's your water. And the level of water is church membership, right, of a national denomination. And it flows up and down. based on six basic factors. And you can remember the top, ballpoint pen, right, BIC, and the bottom, DOS, right, your software in your computer, DOS. So B is births, okay? More births, more members. Deaths is D, of course. People dying off, your membership goes down. I and O is in and out. That refers to switchers, people who are affiliated with one religious body, and they switch in, and that your water level goes up. Or they switch out and affiliate with another religious group, and that's the O. So switchers in, switchers out. C is converts. This would be folks who have no religion at all and have come to the Christian faith, such as one attendee here who was interim pastor of our church, a young woman who was raised completely non-religious in Canada and came to a vital Christian faith initially through a Pentecostal ministry in British Columbia. And S is the secular drain, secularization. That means folks who may actually be on the church roll somewhere, but are unchurched, are not involved in the life of faith, don't have any interest in it, and may be completely non-religious in their beliefs. So the water level goes up and down based on a combination of all six of these factors, and perhaps some others we could throw in, but these are the basic ones. Now, just to quickly note some things that have been going on in religion, births are one reason why Hispanic Catholic congregations are growing. We probably should add immigration in here, and I guess that would count perhaps in any of those top three lines. And also Mormons, at least until recent years, tended to have larger families. And not so long ago, the Christian Reformed Church had larger families than was typical in the United States and Canada. Okay, and usually if you have a lower birth rate, you have a higher death rate. The Episcopal Church is a very interesting three-way example. Lower birth rate. So the Episcopal Church has a lower birth rate than the American average, and that's hurting their numbers. However, they do very well with switching in. The Episcopal Church gets a significant number of adult converts drawn to its the beauty of the Book of Common Prayer and the arts and music and worship style that the church has preserved. This is what we call sheep stealing in less polite moments. And the Episcopalians are quite good at that. However, they have a huge problem right here. Folks raised in the Episcopal Church who drift away and lose interest in religion as teenagers and young adults. So there's a real drain of folks born and bred in the Episcopal Church, as well as some switching, including the schism that's going on right now, which is going to increase those problems. Now, the Assemblies of God and other Pentecostal groups are very good at converts. They're quite effective at that. The Southern Baptist Convention talks up conversion like mad, but they're not actually very good at it from everything I've been able to figure out. However, they're very good at holding folks raised in the Southern Baptist Convention. Somehow, you know, not quite what Southern Baptist, always a Southern Baptist, but they're pretty effective at keeping their teenagers and young adults, as is Mormonism, another growing religion of our time. The Christian Reformed Church, of course, underwent a schism on the women's issue, so they suffered the O factor, switchers out, and you can apply this to your own denomination, I'm sure, and think about it. Now, the aforementioned seeker churches were a response to the challenge of those secularized or largely unchurched baby boomers who would be in the S category. This is identified as those born right after World War II and up through around 1964. It seemed that they wanted religion to be casual, fluid, low demand, open to the desires of the attendees, who were sort of customers as much as disciples, and focused on individual fulfillment and problem solving. But analysts tell us that the younger generations are rather different. They're caught in a society where values, institutions, job prospects, careers, places of residence are greatly in flux, and a divorce of their parents is very commonplace. They're looking for the assurance of stability, perhaps above everything else. And like those South Africans singing their national anthem, they value closely knit communities and would give that more priority than the individualism, which was the hallmark of the baby boomers. This could mean that the small church, which has dominated U.S. Protestant life through history, could make a comeback and may already be making a comeback. And the boomers, of course, are becoming yesterday's news. Last October 15th, there was a publicity event in Washington when the first baby boomer filed for Social Security. 80 million baby boomers will soon follow. As part of this, younger Americans may be giving church tradition another look, and I'll mention three straws in the wind, and we'll begin with the cover story in the Christmas issue of U.S. News and World Report, which says, "A return to ritual, why many modern worshipers, including Catholics, Jews, and evangelicals, are embracing tradition." According to this article, there's a return to tradition and orthodoxy, to past practices, observances, and customary ways of worshiping, which they called more substantial than a trend, less organized than a movement. There's also anecdotal evidence from other journalists about a shift away from the baby boomer ethos and a growing sense that church should feel more like church again, and that tradition may have value. Now, second star on the wind, the epitome of the secret church, of course, is the Willow Creek Community Church outside Chicago. Last summer, Willow reported on a three-year self-study, which also involved 30 other congregations, both Willow Creek clone congregations and other types of churches. And two Willow Creek staffers wrote a book about this. Pastor Bill Hybels called the study earth-shaking, and the staff vowed that fundamental changes will result in the Willow Creek ministry. The nub of the findings is that spending of millions of dollars to make attendees dependent on programs that are quite elaborate does not necessarily produce mature and growing Christian disciples. This is causing a second look at some old-fashioned traditions. Heibel said, quote, "We should have taught people how to read their Bible between services, how to do spiritual practices much more aggressively on their own. These old-fashioned practices do not require large or costly buildings, elaborate programs, or sizable staffs." Conservative theologian Michael Horton, who is quite critical of the Willow Creek model, says the underlying problem here is that, quote, "it's increasingly difficult to swim against the tide of secularism, consumerism, and narcissism in the culture," end quote. So in that sense, he's rather charitable toward Willow Creek, even while criticizing it. Now, we have a third straw in the wind, which I personally consider the most revealing, and that's empirical research conducted by Robert Withnow, who directs the Center for the Study of Religion at Princeton University. In his recent book, After the Baby Boomers, which I would recommend to any pastors in the audience, it's a sociological study of Americans in their 20s and 30s. Again, the title, After the Baby Boomers, and the author, Robert Withnow, W-U-T-H-N-O-W. Withnow says that as challenging as the baby boomers have been for the church, the current generation of young adults poses far more serious problems for Christianity. They're less likely to attend worship than preceding generations. And Withnow and other analysts worry that, unlike the baby boomers, who, when they matured, married, settled down, had children, tended to float back to church, they may not be returning to church. There are serious indications of that. summarizing his examination of Americans in their 20s and 30s, Wuthnacht concludes that, quote, unless religious leaders take young adults more seriously, the future of American religion is in doubt, end of quote. Again, unless religious leaders take young adults more seriously, the future of American religion is in doubt. Now, for our very specific purposes this weekend, the most important aspect in Wuthnacht's study affects music, the worship wars, the life of local congregations. And I'll write some of these numbers on the board just to underscore them. These are responses to a random sample survey conducted by Wuthnacht in a study of art and music in American congregations. The question was, do you want your church to use contemporary worship style and music? Okay. Folks 65 and above, 14% said yes. No surprise, right? These are the old fogies. Okay. 46 to 64 years of age, 16% said yes, so a little higher. Okay, 40 to 45, we're up to 22%. And then folks in their 30s said yes by 20%. Now, Americans in their 20s, do you want contemporary music, Christian music in your worship? What do you think the number was? Any guesses? Give me a guess, anybody. 30? 18? 10? Okay, the answer is, if I can find it here. Twelve percent. The new fogies. Okay. Now, putting all this together, what do we have? We have that folks who really go for contemporary Christian music are a minority group in every age category, a distinct minority, often less than a fifth, and never more than a fourth. The bump comes with the baby boomers, the Willow Creek generation, right? 22%. And the very beginning of Generation X, the oldest folks in the next generation after the baby boomers. But then it declines. And then we have that remarkable 12% figure among people in their 20s, which I think more than anything I've seen in the last several years underscores what I was saying about a yearning for roots and stability and heritage and looking again at tradition and all that sort of thing. That seems to characterize young Americans, and for reasons that we can well understand. So, where does this leave us? There's a fair interest, great interest, in music and the arts among young American adults, Wuthnacht tells us. But he encourages church people to think more carefully about use of the arts outside of worship, which would involve performance of new music, art festivals, literary discussions, all these things that could be sponsored by churches. Whatever happens in the worship life of the congregation. So we all know that young Americans are huge consumers of music, and music will be very, very important in worship. And the quality of musical performance will be extremely important with the younger generation. The beauty of visual arts inside and outside of the sanctuary will be vital. All of these things will be very important. I wonder about the sense of smell. And we're talking about the eye and the ear. You know, is incense going to come back into Protestant worship? Something to think about. Now, finally, since this is a largely Protestant crowd, I should say just a bit about homiletics. St. Augustine wrote that a sermon has three goals: to instruct, to inspire, to delight. Inspiration, touching the heart, changing outlooks, actions, motivations. This is probably one of the key reasons why those white evangelical and black Protestant churches have been growing in the past generation. Inspiration. Now, instruction is a very tough thing because today's preachers are looking out at a congregation where knowledge about the Christian faith varies very widely. I've heard it said that 19th century American farmers with sixth grade educations knew more Bible than most Americans today who have doctoral degrees. The third goal is to delight, or let's face it, to entertain. This is increasingly important in the kind of media-saturated world that we live in. Like classroom teachers, tomorrow's preachers will have to pay increasing attention to humor and to the vigor and beauty of the language they use, and the ways in which the spoken word can be, yes, entertaining, but also thought-provoking and memorable. And in doing so, they will be imitators of Christ, who used puzzling tales, arresting images, and figures of speech to burn into the recollections of his followers what his teachings were. And these were passed on memorably to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and therefore on to us. Now, we have a few moments for questions, but I'll mention I'm doing an informal question and answer thing this afternoon. If you have any interest in the news business or trends in American religion, that type of thing, we'll be talking about that this afternoon. But I might say, just for a couple questions here, don't feel at all limited to anything I've been talking about this morning. If you have curiosities about the media or religious events, that kind of thing, feel free. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Reservations about that or concerns. Do you see the pendulum perhaps swinging back towards people even in worship wanting more reading, less video?
I don't know that I see the pendulum swinging back, although you may, and you may have very valid reasons for seeing that, or others here. It seems to me that the story of the past generation has been a steady march away from text and reading and toward more video stimulation. And as best I can tell, that is continuing, and I expect it to continue into the future. But if there are contrary signs of the times, why, I'd be happy to hear it. Yes, you're next.
Mm-hmm. Could you give us a couple of reasons why that would be so when they are so similar in many ways?
Canada is kind of mysterious because Canada was very similar to the United States religiously up until fairly recently. But I guess the best explanation is that Canada is halfway between Western Europe and the United States culturally. And if you look at what's happening in France and the United Kingdom, Canada is sort of culturally part of that sphere in a way that the United States is not, and it seems to, be more like Western Europe and less like the United States all the time. And this is pretty much a post-World War II phenomenon, as best I can tell. But that's a hunch, but it's the best I can do. Yes, you were next.
Mm-hmm. If 12% of this next generation only wants contemporary music,
doesn't want.
Oh, 12%.
Yeah. In other words, 12%. say we want to have contemporary music.
Okay.
So, surprisingly few, yeah.
Why the huge boom in the industry, the tens of thousands of young people that buy it,
mm-hmm.
and, I mean, it's just a huge business and organization, and the churches that have been successful that are growing, mm-hmm. do use that music, so I'm curious about that whole dichotomy there.
Yeah, I would, needless to say, I was surprised at that 12%. Now, Wuthnow's explanation, remember the distinction between what goes on outside Sunday worship, or weekend worship, we should say, and the rest. In other words, he says there's a fair amount of consumption of music, including contemporary Christian music, by younger Americans. But there seems to be a wish to have a more traditional flavor in the gathered congregational worship. And also, I mean, we shouldn't be too absolute about this. If I understand his findings, it's not that you should never sing anything written after 1900 or what. In other words, you know, maybe a little bit here and there, but the general orientation or feeling is more tradition, less of the CCM approach to worship. But outside worship, music and arts and visual things and theater, all that kind of thing, are really, you know, part of the life of young Americans, and things that church programming more broadly should be part of. And it's certainly true in this past generation. Churches that have used CCM strategically have been growing. And that, as I mentioned, that possibly has hurt mainline, although I don't think it's the key factor. Yes, sir. This will be the last question, I'm afraid. Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, at one point in time, the hymns that have come from the 16th and 17th century were new and ruffled a lot of feathers when they were probably introduced in their context. But isn't it important to keep, you know, creativity within the church, to keep moving forward, to keep adding to the canon of hymns?
Mm-hmm.
So, though they may have a more contemporary sound to it, but they speak more to the culture that sing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in case you didn't hear that, it's an important note from a younger voice, and that is, isn't it important to always have creativity and change, and each generation is giving expression to its faith in new ways and so on. And, of course, that's true. I would say, though, I think the blending or the way in which new concepts, new sounds are introduced is very important. And I'll take an example from a different realm, and that's the classical concert stage. In my view, orchestras have hurt their audiences when they program too much of post-1950 or post-1970 long hair classical compositions without carefully knitting it in with the, you know, the top 40 or the more familiar, you know, Brahms, Beethoven, whatever. When you do that in a classical concert, if you do it wrongly or too much of it or too ideologically, it suppresses the audience. And I suspect you have the same thing in a church congregation where you do have to deal with people of a lot of different ages and so on. But surely there needs to be room for some creativity. The tricky thing for clergy and worship planners in the room this morning is to do it in a way that will unite the people in congregational worship in an effective way. And I mean, that's a real challenge. This huge creativity, as I said, in this past generation, and out of it will come, I think, a lot of, you know, very, very interesting results. Well, that's it. Thank you.